Little Aerosmith. Rock 90.3 on this Thursday morning. Very nice to have you with us. 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. And it is a Thursday morning, and we are thrilled that you are with us. It's the 10th of September, and we thank you for joining us. Let me introduce the panel to you. A quick reminder, all you have to do to be with us and to join in on the conversation, and I anticipate, I don't know, but I anticipate people are going to have a lot to say this morning. So if you want to get in on it, all you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to include you in the festivities. Let me introduce the people who are the festivities this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I was out very early. I have to get out now when it's sort of turning, just turning light. You know, it's dark still. And there is one young lady who passes me at a great rate of speed who has a blue light, a blue blinking light, like it's a police car in Massachusetts. It's all blue, passing me. I got to get me one of them. I got to figure out where to get it. Probably online somewhere.
So she wears it to so she can be seen and is not is not picked off. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I got to get me one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm sure.
Then I got to get me a truck. Yeah.
Well, you don't need to walk if you have a truck.
It's not a watch. It's I think it's a band around her.
No, I said you don't have to walk if you get a truck, right?
Oh no, you got to walk. You got to walk. Right. It's the way you save your life. Yeah.
All right, save your life. Well, good morning, Alan. Thank you very much. And also, we welcome immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Sienna, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm doing well.
It's great to have
you
back.
Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you here. We welcome Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, in the house. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Good morning to you.
Very nice to have you with us. And we welcome Linda Ellerbe, Peabody, an Emmy Award-winning journalist, and our dear friend. Good morning, Linda. How are you?
Overwhelmed by the credentials of my co-panelists today. They actually know something, and they're educated. I'm here just to shoot off my mouth.
Nobody is smarter than you are.
Well, and yes, well, you've worked a lifetime to get to that point. Yeah,
I'll trade you a couple papers for one of the Peabody's.
Get up and believe six impossible things before breakfast. I'm definitely an Alice in Wonderland. I'm Alice in Wonderland. Yep.
Well, let's start talking about all of this. There's a ton about this. It's one of those things that, it happened. This story broke about the Woodward book early afternoon, and then just this cascade. So you assume everyone knows the story, but I'm just going to back it up and talk a little bit about it, and then we'll go into some more detail. But this is the new book is out from Bob Woodward, or it will be out next week, and the early copy of it made its way to the Washington Post, obviously. So President Trump's head popped up during his top secret intelligence briefing in the Oval Office on January 28th when the discussion turned to the coronavirus outbreak in China. This will be the biggest national security threat you face in your presidency, National Security Advisor Robert C. O'Brien told Trump, according to a new book by Bob Woodward, Washington Post Associate Editor. This is going to be the roughest thing you face. Matthew Pottinger, the Deputy National Security Advisor, agreed. He told the president that after reaching contacts in China, it was evident that the world faced a health emergency on par with the flu pandemic of 1918, which killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide. 10 days later, Trump called Woodward and revealed that he thought the situation was far more dire than what he had been saying publicly. "You just breathe the air and that's how it's passed," Trump said in a February 7th call. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than even your strenuous flu. Another, by the way, the name of the new book is Rage. Another one is that Another tidbit from this book is that in a March 19th interview with Bob Woodward, when asked what made him pivot on the gravity of the virus, Trump says, "To be honest with you, I wanted to always play it down." And then there is also another conversation that Woodward reports on that was released that took place just in June 19th, and was asked if his privilege means that he has to work harder to understand the anger fueling protesters. Trump says, quote, "Wow, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you, Bob?" All right. A lot just in that, and there's a lot more. So let's start with that. Alan?
Well, first of all, the whistle is racist, obviously. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to win the election, and if he does, he'll win it because his major appeal is that, you know, this is a racist country and that he's going to try to get to those people who are afraid of black people and Hispanic people. And these tapes with Woodward show it. A lot of people are thinking he made a mistake in doing this. I think it was purposeful, and I think as a guy who was manipulative, he knew what he was doing. That's the first thing. The second thing is there's a lot of stuff that is coming out. But since he is a lying liar, we have no idea of whether anything he says has any validity to it at all. There's an assumption that he got suckered by having this time with Woodward. I don't think so. I think he knew what he was doing. And it plays into the racist approach that he has in America.
Linda.
Well, I agree with Alan. I have heard a number of people say in the last almost 24 hours since this story came out that, boy, he was dumb enough to talk to Bob Woodward. Well, truthfully, he wanted to talk to Bob Woodward. He sat for 18 phone calls. Bob Woodward is the best-known political journalist in America, and he has written books about every president since Nixon, and we all remember how that one started. And Trump was angry that he had not been interviewed by Woodward for his earlier book, Fear. And he wanted to be interviewed by Woodward because he believes in his heart that he is so charming himself and able to, quote, negotiate the deal and persuade anybody of anything, that he could come off better if he talked to Woodward than if he didn't, which was true in Fear. I mean, this is hubris writ large, like billboard size. Because Trump honestly believes, in my mind, he truly believes that in any situation, he is the smartest guy in the room.
Right.
If I may paraphrase you'd have to be very old to remember this. I know Bob Woodward. I know Donald Trump. You can take it from there. Donald Trump is no Bob Woodward.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Brains.
I don't know that I agree with you. I think, you know, it is not only his hubris, but it is the question as to whether or not he knows the American people and the strain of racism that exists in this country better than most of us do. And it says, this is the way that I'm going to get reelected as president. Well, and I think he harnessed it.
I mean, that's one part of it. But the other part of it, of keeping the virus, of talking about the virus and talking about of downplaying it, is, I don't know. I mean, to almost sort of breathlessly telling Bob Woodward how bad it is, and then Bob Woodward saying, okay, but, you know, this seems, and asking him, Bob Woodward is asking him in one of the clips, okay, you pivot, you pivoted. What caused you to pivot? And he said, well, I didn't pivot. I've just been downplaying it.
Well, he did it, but Joe, he did it for a reason. His downplaying it obviously is a rationale for his misbehavior when it came to letting the American people know, look, we live in a democracy, so a sort of democracy anyway. We do. And, you know, if the basis of democracy is information, and if people don't have information, how can they make judgments from the people, democracy? So I think, you know, he was saying, these people are too dumb. The people are too dumb for me to tell them the truth. We have to avoid a panic, and I'm not going to tell them the truth. But he's really saying, I blew it, and here's why I blew it.
Well, but also, I mean, back to your earlier point, also, this is the way I win the election. If I downplay it, if I don't make a big deal about it, then it's not going to hurt the economy. It's not going to have the impact that it ultimately had. Jim, what do you make of it?
You know, I took a different message from some of this. I listened to a lot of the clips and tapes, and the Trump who you hear talking on that is talking in almost full sentences, rationally clear. Now, some of that may be changed from February to now, but when he talks in public and talks in, you know, these little pieces and sound bites, here it was very clear he was being deliberate, that he knew what he was talking. You know, people who say he gets confused, people who say, he says this and that and doesn't mean it. This stuff, he was talking one-on-one, he was clear, he was deliberate, and he said exactly what he knew and exactly what he was doing. It's, you know, months ago when Alan was saying some of these things, it sounded like, you know, is this a conspiracy theory? Here we have it in Trump's own words. So, you know, it's amazing. It's clear, it's deliberate.
Sienna.
You know, what I walked away from this is that, and I admittedly, I thought after, you know, the DNC, I agreed. I thought he was, like, unfit to be a president. He just didn't have the capability. But when I heard this interview and this tape, I was like, oh, this is strategic. He actually does understand. And that was shocking to me. And one of the things that I took home was he said that there is systematic racism. He said less here than other places. But he acknowledges that there's systematic racism, which means to me that he understands what's going on in the U.S. I believe Alan was saying that. He does understand. He gets it. And this is just a strategy these last 2 weeks to push this law and order and to push the rioting and the protesting. It's all a strategy. And that's what I took away from these tapes is that he's more strategic than I gave him credit for.
Well, in the tapes and the excerpt of the pride, weird pride that he has in what he's going to do in Lafayette Square, is odd. I mean, not completely, you know, not shocking, but just, you know, look at what we're going to do in this great pride. I do think it is interesting. I think Linda touched on this, but it is, you know, in many cases, he called Bob Woodward, which is, he was on the record. He called Bob Woodward. And that is, that's interesting as well, because he's pushing a lot of this himself. Linda, how do you think about when this...
One thing I'd like to
yes,
ask.
Yes, please.
One of the problems I'm having this morning is I feel like, although the two are absolutely connected, the racism and coronavirus, it's almost like when you're texting back and forth to someone and they're answering the question that you asked two questions back because you're...
Can we
separate out, for just purposes of talking, the coronavirus part from the racism part, because the racism part is also going to get us into Homeland Security. And I have a great deal to say on that. But
me too.
Just speaking to the coronavirus part for a while, if before we get off that,
yep.
I want to hear what everybody has to say on the racism part, which starting with the Kool-Aid and going on from there to what is happening. On the coronavirus part, I think that Joe Biden actually nailed it when he said, he failed to do his job on purpose, and that basically sums it up. Yeah. But the other question, while we're staying on coronavirus, is that now all of a sudden, more and more, the people are coming out and saying, well, you know, we knew this all along. Mattis, all of these people, who we knew this all along. We knew this all along. I'm so tired of hearing that. Why am I to think you're brave to come out and say it now? Why did you keep your mouth shut then? Same question is being asked of Bob Woodward these days. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you report this about coronavirus? Right. You might have saved some lives. Why didn't the people in the administration who knew this man was lying report this either?
Well, Linda just set it up beautifully. We have three major things to discuss when we come back from a break. One of them is a continuation of this about the coronavirus, and then, of course, talking about the racial aspect of it. And yes, I would like to talk about Bob Woodward and why his duty as a journalist and not reporting this sooner, which I know is something that has come up often in his career as he writes this book, as Linda mentioned, is about every president since Nixon. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. A good panel this morning. A lot to talk about. We welcome your thoughts. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Linda Ellerbe this morning. And yes, we welcome your questions, your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org. That's panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this news from the BBC. Playing Aerosmith this morning, Joe Perry is 70 years old, 70 years old, and I think 70-year-olds around the country are looking themselves in the mirror and saying, oh, I don't look that bad. So, good morning and happy birthday to Joe Perry. We have on our panel this morning Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jim Henler, and Linda Ellerbe, and we certainly welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jim, anything you'd like to say about what Linda was talking about before the break?
Lots, but, you know, I think with a lot of the books coming out, I mean, there have been so many reveal books, and, you know, they're all timed to come out now for maximum impact in terms of sales and things like that. I think this one really needs to be the one people pay attention to for all the three different issues you raised right before the break. You know, this one is Trump in his own words. Woodward has a long history of reporting on presidents. I think this is credible, and I think people need to pay attention.
I just think you guys have got it wrong. I think they may want to, you may want them to pay attention, but pay attention to what? I think he's a racist, and I think his whole appeal is racism. And I think the reason he gave, despite his White House protestations that he didn't, the reason he gave this access is because he wanted to get his racist message out there. When he says to Woodward, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you, when Woodward is talking to him about white privilege and how he and the president both had white privilege, he said, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you? That's a message. That is a message. Okay, America, even those of you who say you're not racist but who really are, get out there and do this. That's what this was all about. And I think it's just one more technique which got him, come on, folks, to be president of the United States. Everybody says he's a dummy, he doesn't know what he's talking about and all the rest of it. I happen to think he's evil, all right, but I think he knows what he's doing.
So Alan, I just don't understand the part about where the panel has it wrong on the other issue, though.
Yeah,
about,
me too.
About the virus.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I would just like to point out, it's a book. We're talking about two lines on the racism. A lot of people have died of coronas. I agree that the campaigning, but it's a book. I am not aware that a lot of Trump supporters are buying Bob Woodward's books.
They're not going to.
I agree that he's a racist, that is why he's campaigning. That is what he is campaigning on. That is who he is. That is who he has always been. And we have no disagreement on that. Nor do I think he's a dummy. I think he is smart. So I'm not sure what disagreement we have on that, Alan.
Okay, so for example, when we hear that we have to really study what he has said here. Yeah, I think we have to study it all right, because I think that in order to understand why he's doing what he's doing and what his racist appeal is, that is so important in this case. You know, when you say, well, I don't know how many people are going to buy the book. Yeah, right. But they're sure going to watch Fox, and they're going to sure watch CNN, and nothing, even the California fires, have proven to be more, well, it's a bad word, but incendiary for the American voter.
Sienna?
You know,
okay, but go, Jim, and then
let Sienna go first.
Okay, Sienna?
Oh, I was just listening, and I was thinking about how, you know, we're relating COVID, and what I was going to say before to Linda's point about let's talk about COVID is that, you know, one of the things he says is the blacks have shown me no love. I'm not getting any love. I do all this for them. But black Americans have been and people of color have been disproportionately affected by COVID.
Exactly.
These are frontline workers, and they're affected the most by COVID. And the fact that he downplayed COVID affected our communities the most. And I think there's no love lost there, and everyone gets exactly what's happening here. And so I agree with Alan that, yes, and I mean everyone else, that there is very racist undertones to this whole thing.
And Jim, go ahead.
So I think there's the racist undertone. I think there's the coronavirus. But Alan, you know, what I think is, and, you know, I've talked about this often on the show, as of you, the race will be won or lost in suburban districts in a few states. And that's where I'm hoping, you know, last week's stuff about the military, this week's stuff about coronavirus, those are issues that hit close to home in that middle class, middle of the political spectrum space. So, you know, I really hope this stuff will help that group counter some of the other things they've been ignoring, really understand this person better. So I do think this could make a difference. Certainly the military things seem to have impacted polls very quickly. And I just hope he's condemning himself in his own words, because, you know, it's hard to deny it when you're on tape.
Let's look at the one thing that Linda brought this up right before the break about, you know, you're really drinking the Kool-Aid, aren't you? Linda, your thoughts on that and how we should take that?
Well, this is a man who obviously, look, the Trump presidency and Trump is based on white male supremacy. Let's be clear. Okay? So anything that threatens that, and that kind of thought loves to paint white males, particularly white Christian males, as victims. We are the victims. Oh, everybody else is the enemy. We are the victims. In Trump's America, to believe otherwise is to drink the Kool-Aid, to see the, quote, the other. That would be, oh, golly, gee, all the rest of us, okay? Of all different colors and gender, all kinds of things. We are the other. To drink the Kool-Aid is to give us equal prominence as human beings. That is a lie to him. He does not believe that. He is a white male supremacist, and he is appealing to white male supremacy. And his entire campaign right now is based on that.
Okay, Linda.
Because
so
he can't win on the economy, and he can't win on his response to the coronavirus.
But we keep hearing that he's looking for suburban housewife votes. So you've just said.
Did you say suburban housewives in Houston a minute ago? Did I hear that?
No. Votes.
No, but, no, not you. No, no.
No, I said in a few. I said in a few suburban. Districts of some of this.
Oh, I thought
states.
You said in Houston. I thought, well, that's
no,
odd.
No, definitely. if it was in Houston, we'd be in trouble.
Houston's fairly blue in its suburbs.
Linda's Texas radar just went up.
I am from Houston. It's a blue island along with Austin in a very red state.
Go ahead, Alan.
So, Linda, the question then is, if he is appealing, as you said, to white males in America, how does this work in terms of the crucial suburban housewife vote?
Well, women have, we have for years voted against our own self-interest with the ERA, with many things. And women voting for Trump in 2016, many people will give you explanations. My own instinct is that many of those women voted for Trump to validate their own choices in life. And, you know, if you have chosen that you not, if you have chosen to not be independent, I'm not, I am not criticizing your choice. But there were women who voted against her, and there are now. And there are women who will, yes, use fear. When they walk in the voting booth, they will be voting their fear. But I think they misunderstand, as many people have said, who the white suburban woman is now. Every time Trump uses that phrase, there is something in that phrase that sounds coming out of his mouth a little derogatory to suburban women, as though he knows who they are and he thinks of them as baking cookies and sitting around and chatting about how to grow avocado plants in the kitchen set windowsill. He may have that very wrong.
There was, Sian, I'm interested in your thoughts on this right before we go to break, but in to Alan's point and question, there is a there was a piece in the 538 of looking at the polls that said Trump could still win the Electoral College despite the poor marks that Americans give him for the handling of COVID, but that Black, Hispanic, and college-educated white voters, according to the polls, who backed him in 2016, are largely still with him, particularly in those swing states. How this goes to Linda of also saying, you know, of women often voting against their self-interest, but how does that happen?
Well, I think a lot of people hear the rhetoric. I mean, he's coming out with this in response to the COVID and him saying he downplayed. He's saying that basically he was trying to give the U.S. calmness and hope, right? He's, you know, hope like Barack Obama. And that's what he was trying to do rather than downplay it, rather than panic, calmness, hope. And that's what people are looking for. That's what people are hanging on to. And that's what, you know, sometimes I hear myself when I'm listening, I'm like, okay, is there anything there? And I think that's what allows them to still vote for him now. Like I mentioned earlier, the fact that he recognized systematic racism at the very least is what people, which what some Blacks say, okay, well, I'm able to vote for him. He recognizes that there's an issue. We can work with him. I think those little nuggets that he leaves allows people to make that connection with him and justify his actions, so to speak.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters, as we predicted we do, and we'll get to those as soon as we come back. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Let's go to some letters. Susan writes, thanks, Linda, for calling out Trump for what he is, at least in part, a white male supremacist. But it's more than that. Fascists have taken over the White House. Isn't it time to start using that term? Define fascism and see how clearly it describes what's happening. Call it what it is, not just part of what it is. We go to Dean, who says it's important to link Trump's lying on tape about COVID to all the lies he has told that were not caught on tape. And is Fox playing the tape on air? I believe they are. I watched Fox last night and they were playing. I saw one, at least one clip played. Chris says the current president screams about the end of suburbia, desperate immigrants, Antifa, and on, and didn't want us to panic? Question mark. Good point there. Fran says, my sister-in-law fell ill in late February. She did not believe there was a virus. She listened to Fox News and the president. She was the first confirmed death from the virus in Tampa, Florida in March. Her children blamed her death on the president. He has confirmed their belief. That was the first thing that struck me, and I'm interested in what the panel makes of that. The first thing that struck me was, wow, in that admission of saying you're downplaying it, that you have all of those lives in your hands, which I think a lot of us thought anyway, but certainly that admission, with that admission comes the guilty verdict.
You know, because he's a lying liar, he can say anything he wants and continues to say everything he wants. And the people who are for him are staying with him. But the fact is that he is responsible. Because he didn't let people know what they needed to do. The South Koreans knew it. They did it, and they saved a hell of a lot of lives. It's a remarkable how well South Korea did. We couldn't do it because he says, quote, I was afraid of causing panic. Well, this is a guy who causes panic as a way of life.
Yeah, look at the difference between New York and the states that have paid attention to Trump. First, the state here and a few others who paid attention to the science.
Brianna says Trump grew up surrounded in a bubble by yes people. Of course he thinks he's the smartest man in the room. The most dangerous people on earth are the ones who have no idea what they're doing but think and act like they do. He felt important being interviewed by Woodward, and that is his only priority in life.
He's the president of the United States, and somehow he got there. Do I think he's pure evil? I do. But do I think he's dumb? Do I discount what he's doing? Do I discount the fact that he's talking to Woodward? No, I think he knew what he was doing when he did it.
I'm not surprised that he called Woodward, says Daisy. There is Trump completely. He has sought legitimacy to be part of the elite that he says he despises, but all he wants is to be part of the cool club in New York. He thought becoming president would give him that legitimacy. It has not. Gerard says, on Tuesday, Trump asked people to vote twice to disqualify the election, vote once by mail and once in person. That is illegal. We have talked about that and made that point, but thank you. Jim says, Trump claims he was acting as a cheerleader for the country. Too bad, because at that moment, we needed a quarterback. That is a good point.
Great analogy.
I think that's why Andrew Cuomo is getting such high marks, because he was a quarterback. And he kept saying, I am going to do what's right as opposed to what's popular. And I think that turned out to be popular in itself.
John says, we give Trump the benefit of the doubt, which I am loath to do. His missing that claiming I was downplaying it is effectively lying to the American people, makes him criminally liable for the deaths of uncountable, liable for the deaths of uncountable people. Linda, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't know that it makes him criminally. First of all, nothing is going to happen to him criminally. Any punishment while he is in office, put that aside. We're facing an election. I agree with just about everything that everybody is saying. I'm with Alan. You know, Alan and I wonder how many more lyings we're going to add to his description, a lying liar, and then a lying liar. And it just keeps on. There is no end to it. What we do with it is what happens in November, and I'm very worried about it, and I think we're all right to be worried.
Absolutely. Lisa writes, lots of women have internalized the paradigm of a patriarchy. I'm pretty sure it's been proven that many women simply vote the way their husband votes and think the way he thinks. Sienna or Linda, anyone want to in on that?
I can tell you it's not true in my house.
That'd be a fact. I've known plenty of women who did that, Sienna, and I bet you have too.
I do. But what I am hopeful for is that we're seeing a new suburban, quote unquote, housewife, right? These are the people that are just coming out of their mostly diverse colleges. And so I think that a lot of people aren't as he would like to think, scared of, you know, the rioters coming into their neighborhood. They're not as scared of those things as maybe they were back in the 60s. I mean, I don't think he's in touch enough to know what the new suburban housewife does. She's on TikTok, and she's looking at all different types of people, and that doesn't scare
me. I agree. I don't think I think when he says suburban housewife, he's speaking in code for white housewife.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you're right. I think he's got it wrong.
Sienna, a great deal has been made about the role of black women in this election. I wonder if you've thought about that at all, because of, you know, we're not talking about all people who are black, the role of black women again and again and again. What do you make of that?
I think that black women have always faced, we've always been a double minority. And so we're very aware of that point and of that aspect of when we're voting. And it has never, it's always been very concise and consistent among, you know, any other Black women that I speak to about how we feel about what's going on in the country. And so, you know, I obviously can't speak for all Black women, but I can say for one thing, when we saw Kamala Harris be VP, everyone was excited on my feed and was, you know, elated. And I just don't think that he pays attention to the fact that there are a lot of Black women are one of the most educated groups right now in colleges and, you know, even above Black men. And so when you say suburban housewife, a lot of times you are talking about Black women. We're there as well. Our children are right alongside with these suburban white housewives, and we're talking to them and we're friends with them. And I think the very narrow viewpoint that he's making, and he's only really speaking to his base.
I want
to
get
to the point of that. There's one other piece of to talk about suburban housewives, as I said, and to use it as in dismissive way. Not only is it code for white housewives, it's code for housewives. Now, housewives, really, what does that imply? That they are wives who stay at the home and that, geez, that's not working. It's the hardest work you'll ever do is raising kids, taking care of a house. But many of these housewives, I'm sorry, many of these he's calling suburban housewives, those are women out going to jobs every day.
Irene
and
makes.
They are women of color and they are women of intelligence. And he has categorized, he has managed to be both racist and misogynist in one sentence in talking about suburban housewives.
Exactly, Linda. That's what I feel like. We always talk about the racism, but we don't talk about the sexism in that statement.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, and how degrading it is by saying that.
To that point, Irene writes, Trump says, housewife, I know suburban women and men. They are intelligent and stay informed. They are mostly not Trump supporters, and they do bake cookies. He's miscalculated the suburban vote, in my opinion.
I think part of that's right, and I think it was actually people staying home. It wasn't people going out and voting for Trump that made the difference. The data proves that, and you know, I've been saying that since 3 days after the last election. So a lot of it will be turnout. A lot of it will be what issues people respond to. I think the COVID issue is going to hurt him because among, you know, the people we're talking about, health and health of their kids and health of their families is an important issue. And I really hope they're going to pay attention to the fact that, you know, he does have this blood on his hands.
I agree with Alan, and Linda says, Vicky, Trump is running on racism. His father was a member of the Klan. He has Stephen Miller as an advisor. The last 4 years have made it obvious. Racism is very prominent in the U.S., much more than we want to believe. This is what is Trump's populism.
KKK here. What we're talking about are a lot of people who say, I haven't got a racist bone in my body, but who are? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the racist strain which puts people of color into such a disadvantaged position in the United States every single day, every single minute, despite the denial and quote and the quotes from the president are meant to reinforce those people in terms of their incipient racism. That's what I'm thinking.
I just for the sake of it, there have been allegations that Fred Trump very early was part of a Klan rally, and that has never been proven, but I just want that. There have been allegations. There was an arrest record once that showed that his father was arrested in an encounter, but it's not sure that it was actually a rally, and so there is some question about it. I don't want that going out as fact when we don't know that it is.
Yeah. The first rule of radio is PTL.
Praise
Protect
the Lord.
Protect the license.
Oh, okay.
Well done, Joe.
All right.
Can I just say, Joe, before you move on really quickly, it's also to just piggyback on what Alan's saying, it's the fear of being displaced as the majority, right? It's
absolutely.
You know, it's not always... Yeah, you know, it's not always just overt racism, KKK. It's the fear of being displaced, and you see it in the little things, like when there was a black lead on Star Wars, or if Spider-Man was black in the cartoon, you know, and people kind of feel uncomfortable, and that's how it manifests itself, and this is what we're dealing with now.
Let's take a
Can I just say one quick thing?
Absolutely.
Joe, or do we have to take a break?
No, you can. No, well, we do have
they
to take a break.
They are being displaced. There are more of us than there are of them. It's only a matter of time. But at the moment, what we're seeing with the white racist, mainly Christian male, because Jews are being singled out and persecuted too. I just keep wanting to say, can you say the name Custer?
And on that note, we're going to take a break.
I hope so.
When we come back, we will continue. I think I got through about a quarter of the letters, so we'll dig in and do some more and move on to other topics as well. There is other news this morning, and it's equally disturbing, so we'll continue in that vein. We'll take a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Thursday morning. It's the 10th of September, 8 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we thank you for being with us. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Linda Ellerby, and Jim Henler making up the panel this morning. We also welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have quite a few letters. I want to get to a few more, and then we're going to move on to other subjects here. But we go to Rich in Amherst, who says, I'd like to hear the panel discuss why they think 40% of the population still supports Trump with all the ongoing reporting of his lying and apparent criminal behavior. I think, Rich, that is a question that we have been grappling with in this program since the election of 2016. But how would the panel like to respond to Rich's question?
I think he thinks it works, period.
And as far as the 40% of the population, and as you said, Alan, that number hasn't moved. So what does that tell us about 40% of the population?
But I've been telling you all along.
there's
a strain of racism in this country. It's unrecognized. If you say to people, are you racist? They say no. But I think that the case can be made that it is not Jim, it is Jim Crow, but it is not the kind of racism that, you know, is doing the terrible things in America that we saw so long. Mm. It is, I think people are just have no sense of their own racist tendencies.
Jim Henler.
Well, so I heard an interview with Tom Friedman last night, which I thought was interesting. He said when he was out talking to the Trump voters, what he was taking away was they cared more about how Trump said things than what he said. That his tone, they like someone that combative. I personally, you know, don't think that's a great thing to say about who you want as the president of the United States. But I think a lot of his voters are somehow responding to the personality and able to tune out what's being said when it doesn't agree with what they hold. So I think the racism and all that we've been talking about is clearly a piece of it, but I think it's much deeper than that.
All right, let's go to, and Mike, can you get Linda back? We lost Linda. Okay. Mark says there are, 9 hours from 18 tapes? And we have had 3 minutes. We have heard 3 minutes so far. Do you think there are more horrifying revelations to come before the book is released next week? Oh, absolutely. Right? I mean, that's just good marketing, I would
say. Absolutely. And little by little, we're already beginning to see it.
Right. Drips and drabs. But oh, my God. Yes, there's going to be more horrifying stuff coming out. All right. That from Mark. Let's see. We go to Diane, who says, do you think the rise of Trump and white angry men is the result of Obama being elected, or do you think this was brewing before Obama? Sienna, do you want to take that?
I definitely think it's a response to Obama. I think it goes back to what Jim was saying, is that they liked when Trump came out against Obama, was speaking about, you know, the birther incident and being tough and not backing down. They liked that. And I think once they pushed this, you know, Obama was, I would like to think he was not an anomaly. I like to think that Obama was a reflection of what our country was. But, you know, I question that more and more watching what's going on in our country and what's happened with Trump. And what, and as they said in the prior email, the letter, the 40%, right? So I think it was a reaction to Obama, but I wasn't prepared for the intense reaction and support that this, that, you know, would happen because of it.
Remembering Sienna, that Hillary Clinton did get 3 million more votes in this country,
right,
than did Trump.
That's true.
So
yeah.
So it isn't as if we don't know where this country is going. We do, and I think that's what scares the hell out of these, out of the Trump supporters. They know where it's going, and they'll do anything do anything to put a stop to it.
Lynn writes, Linda, we're drowning out here. White male supremacists are not playing at all right now in the flyover. I may be a feminist, but I'm not listening right now to feminist rhetoric in this dangerous situation.
I don't get that. Can somebody explain that one to me?
I don't understand.
Yeah, okay. I don't either. So we'll move on.
Could you read it one more time? Maybe we'll get it then.
Oh.
Did you get rid of it already?
Well,
I did.
But that's, no, here it is. Here it is. Linda, we are drowning out here. And she says WMS. We have determined that to be white male supremacist. Although it stands for many things. But anyway, is not playing at all right now in the flyover. I may be a feminist, but I'm not listening right now to feminist rhetoric in this dangerous situation.
What? Okay, I don't get it.
Sorry.
Okay, and there we go. We go to Natalie. Can everyone please stop throwing around the term housewife without acknowledging what an outdated, sexist, and demeaning term it is? I don't know anyone who self-identifies with this term, and to reduce a woman's identity to her relationship with a house and a husband is extremely demeaning. P.S. It's not 1950 anymore. My husband does housework and cares for the kids, too. I don't hear anyone call him a house husband. Well, Natalie, the reason we're using that term is because that is the term the president used, and so we're responding to that.
And we have made our feelings on it plain.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a point.
That it is inaccurate, that we agree with this woman, or yeah. I'm presuming it's a woman who wrote that,
Natalie,
100%.
Yes. Alan?
Yeah, but it's a point well taken, sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree.
Scarlett says, love the panel, but I'm astounded.
Well, and I do want to make it clear.
No, go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say, you know, I've been very careful when I've talked about it to say it's voters, because it's not just women. It's that entire demographic that really will have a huge impact on this election.
Well, wait a second. Uh-oh, let's be careful here. When the political analysts, the guys who are working for Trump and Biden and everybody else, are looking specifically at who votes and how to tailor their messages to those people who vote. So far, are we all safe? We're all together? So if it turns out that black women, for example, vote in large numbers, which are not known to other minorities, communities, that becomes extremely important. And the same goes for people who are living in suburbia who happen to be women, who turn out to be crucial. That's all I'm going to say is that that's why it may be sexist, it may be incorrect to use it, but in fact, that's what the political people who are working for Trump and Biden are looking at.
Well,
and they're wrong, because housewife is sexist and shouldn't be used. And that shows
whether
their operatives think that way. Words count, Alan. They do. Keep calling women housewives.
No, you and I,
they want to say white suburban voters. Maybe they want to say, but housewife is.
Yeah. You and I agree on that, Linda. Mm-hmm. I don't see what the
Trump managers, if you will, also want to use that term tells you something about attitudes towards women from the White House.
Well, and it's
true.
But isn't it just we so often have heard that in the myth/reality that was the 2016 election, that Hillary needed to do a lot better with white white suburban voters.
That's true. But white suburban voters is not the saying as saying suburban housewives.
So this is almost a derivation of that from the Trump side. Yes. Okay. Let's go to other letters. And Scarlett says, love the panel, but I'm astounded that you make all these excuses for suburban white housewives. You're befuddled by why they would vote for Trump. It's simple. Life is better for them under Trump. Now they are worried about protests and angry mobs in their neighborhoods. Sorry, don't make excuses for them. They vote the way they want, and they're very intelligent. And by the way, so are black suburban housewives who are also voting the same way. Anyone want that?
Black suburban housewives are certainly, I don't want to speak for them, but the demographics I've seen certainly are not voting for Trump.
Sienna?
Agreed,
unless I got
Alan.
That wrong.
Agreed, Alan. I haven't heard many people. I mean, I think that's a pretty, you can tell
generic.
By the way the Trump's campaign is going. They're not reaching out to black women to vote for them. They
and
know
he's not feeling the love,
something.
He says.
Yes, he's not feeling the love.
That would be accurate.
Well, they are trying everything they can to suppress black votes.
Also a good point. Diane says, do you think the rise of Trump and white angry men is the result of Obama? We already read that. I apologize. We go.
No, it's the result of 400 years of America. I'm sorry. It is not the result of Trump. He just made it. He validated it.
Another Suzanne writes and says the worst aspect of this is that it looks like he knew in plenty of time and could have mitigated the damages many other leaders have regarding the virus. That's
exactly.
The unforgivable aspect of it. He had a golden opportunity here and blew it. Cuomo did it right.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that is absolutely right. The damage here and his excuse is, well, I didn't want to cause panic. But what he did was to cause tens of thousands of American lives that didn't have to get lost. It's just unbelievable.
By the end of next week, we are predicting to break 200,000. And
can you imagine?
I won't even tell you the scary numbers we're looking at in our predictions right now if things don't change.
So I want to get to another aspect of this story, and that is this is from The Washington Post. Two waves of outrage greeted the news on Wednesday of Bob Woodward's latest White House Chronicle, a book titled Rage. The first was Trump's disclosures that we have talked about at length this morning. The second was that Woodward, long associated with The Washington Post, didn't reveal this to the public sooner. The fact that this second outrage mostly circulated among journalists talking to one another made it no less furious. If the famous Watergate reporter knew that Trump was lying to the public about a matter of life and death, why didn't he reveal it immediately? Woodward is hardly the first journalist to save juicy information for a book, but is this traditional practice still ethical? Tweeted David Boardman, dean of the Temple University Journalism School and the longtime editor of the Seattle Times. Other critics were less circumspect. This is really troubling. As journalists, we're supposed to work in the public interest. I think there's been a failure here, wrote Scott Nover, a reporter for the industry journal Adweek. In fairness, it wasn't just journalists raising concerns. Washington Post reader wrote, arguing that Woodward's revelation could have been helpful in the spring, both explaining the seriousness of the disease to the public, showing the Trump administration bungled and inept response, and pushing the Trump administration to do more. The writer added with a touch of cynicism that he hoped the author's advance fee made the delay worthwhile.
I hope that everybody will listen to the Media Project this week because we spent almost the entire half an hour on this very subject.
Linda, what do you think?
Well, I did not listen to the Media Project, so
it's coming.
I do not know what was
said. It's coming. It's coming, Linda. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, it's not. It's not a reality until it hits the radio on Sunday.
Well, first of all, Woodward says that in the beginning he didn't know if Trump was lying or not because Trump so often lies, and that he had not checked his sources and had not gotten the confirmation. That is a legitimate thing. Secondly, the argument that journalists do this all the time is not necessarily, I don't think, a particularly good one. However, I am not certain that if it came out then that it would have been taken very seriously. It took a body bag count to make this important. And what is important is that it got out before the election, is that it got out now, and that it is nailed down, and that the tapes are there. and it is now very clear. I am not a fan of burning the messenger in this case. I do not think when it came out or how it came out is as important as the fact that we know it now. However, I am not somebody who lost a loved one during this time, and I can imagine how they must be feeling.
Absolutely. And it also, it seems to me that that many of us, I don't want to speak for everyone on this panel, but I mean, I think all the conversations we were having in February and March were he's downplaying this, right? I mean, it's not like we didn't expect it. You know, there's going to be 15 cases and it's going to go away, and then it's going to go away by March and it's going to go away by April. I mean, that's what we talked about constantly on this program and the national conversation as well, which was they're downplaying it, which continues, yeah. Obviously.
Which we all believed and was true.
Right.
It has been true. This has confirmed it. This is possibly one of the biggest smoking guns of all time. And what we do with that information is what counts right now. Look, let us just go back a little bit and remember that what Nixon, Clinton, what brought them down always was not so much the deed as the cover-up.
Right.
We have just been presented with the tapes, the cover-up. What happens next? We'll see.
Sienna, anything you'd like to add to that?
I agree with Helen and Linda. I don't think you can shift even an iota of the blame away from President Trump. We have been seeing Governor Cuomo juxtaposed next to President Trump's response since March. So we knew that it was not sufficient. He wasn't giving us enough information. So whether or not the book came out in March or now, it wouldn't have made a big difference.
So in shifting the subject slightly, Dan writes, okay, but what are the Democrats going to do with this information? That is an interesting question. Democrats led by presidential nominee Joe Biden denounced Trump's actions as part of a deliberate effort to lie to the public for his own political purposes when other world leaders took decisive action to warn their people and set those nations on a better path to handling the pandemic. Biden said he knew and purposely played it down. Worse, he lied to the American people. He knowingly and willingly lied about the threat it posed to the country for months. Biden said this in front of the United Auto Workers Training Facility in Warren, Michigan, where he delivered a speech on a Made in America plan for the economy. Biden called Trump's actions a life and death betrayal of the American people. Let's talk about the politics of this. Alan, what does Joe Biden do with this information?
Well, the first thing he does is he has to be vehement in his remarks, and he is. Do I think he has to be a little bit more expressive? Yes, I do. I think his big dilemma, and I've said this before, is that on the one hand, he doesn't want to sound like Trump. He doesn't want to be, you know, crazy-like. But on the other hand, he also has to be assure people that he isn't Trump. He's not that kind of person, but that he can go toe-to-toe with Trump. And so far, I think he's good, but I think he's missing the mark. I think he has to raise the tone a little bit in order to get people to say, yeah, this is the guy to lead us.
Linda?
I agree with Alan. I mean, I think the strongest thing and the most simple, understandable thing he said is that he mishandled the virus and he did it on purpose.
Sienna.
That's the message that has to be said over and over and over. Your lives, if the economy is messed up, if you've lost someone, if this is affecting your people of color more than it is other people, and it is, if you were affected by any of those things, this man did it to you on purpose. He knew it, and he did it on purpose.
And Biden says it's almost. Yep. And Biden says it's almost criminal. That's what he said.
Yeah, and I agree with Linda. I think, and he needs to focus that message and getting individuals out to vote. in just kind of using it as a catalyst for them to get out and get and vote, because this person doesn't have your best interest at heart. I think that's the most effective message, because we need more people to come out and vote like they did in the 2012 election in 2008.
And we can't just nail it on the virus here. We've got to spread this, what his decision-making did to you who can't afford your rent, who are being evicted, who are having trouble feeding your families, who've lost your business, who live in marginal neighborhoods, who have no health coverage. Every one of you is affected by this decision to lie to you on purpose in order to get reelected. Sienna's completely right on that.
We just have a minute or so before we go over to the news, and then we will wrap up. Fauci also came into the Woodward conversation as well, and speaking out about the president. He is now backtracking a little bit on that, and was on Fox News yesterday. And saying that he didn't believe that the he didn't remember saying that, and he felt.
I don't remember.
Yeah,
I don't remember that.
I don't know. It was.
And what did he say? He said something about, because
I'm trying to bring up the exact quote here. Yeah. Fauci is quoted in one of the tidbits that came out from the book, from the Woodward book, is that Fauci was telling. Was telling Woodward about his frustration in dealing with the administration, and I believe the word rudderless was used. That then Fauci went on Fox News last night and said he didn't get any sense that Trump was distorting anything about the coronavirus, and that was his comment as of last night. I'll try to find the full quote during the break. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last go round and our last segment together. As we wrap up, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. This is what I was looking for earlier before the break. Dr. Anthony Fauci on Wednesday shot down journalist Bob Woodward's reporting that he once said President Trump was, quote, unfocused in meetings and that his sole purpose is to get reelected, saying he doesn't recall that at all. Fauci, the administration's top infectious diseases expert, was quoted in Woodward's new book as disparaging the president's, quote unquote, rudderless leadership and saying his, quote, attention span is like a minus number. Fauci last night with John Roberts on Fox said, if you notice, it was others who have said that. You should ask others. I don't recall that at all.
Well, right. Fauci has to walk the sharp side of the razor blade, always has, you know, and too bad, because, you know, I'm sure that this is the one that would put him over the side. And he hasn't been fired yet. He's been able to survive, which I think is a damn good thing for the American people that we have him. But clearly this political game has its rough edges.
All right, let's talk about one other, let's see, we may get two stories in, but let's see how we do. DHS downplayed threats from Russia and white supremacists, according to a whistleblower, Brian Murphy, the former head of the Department of Homeland Security's Intelligence Division, accused senior leaders of warping the agency around President Trump's political interests. Top officials with the Department of Homeland Security directed agency analysts to downplay threats from violent white supremacy and Russian election interference. That, according to this whistleblower complaint, Brian Murphy, as I mentioned, the former head of the Homeland Security Department's intelligence branch, said in the complaint that he was ordered this spring by Chad Wolf, the acting secretary of the department, to stop producing assessments on Russian interference and focus instead on Iran and China. That request, Mr. Murphy said, was routed through Mr. Wolf from Robert C. O'Brien, the White House National Security Advisor. Mr. Wolf later told him not to disseminate a report on a Russia disinformation campaign to denigrate Joe Biden Jr.'s mental health because it made the president look bad, said Mr. Murphy, who warned that the actions in their totality threatened national security. Who wants in? Jim, I heard you moan first.
You know, I have said consistently, well, first of all, let me deny, you know, that what I'm speaking now is any way related to my role in, as an advisor once upon a time to DHS. It was under the last administration. But I want to say that something I've said repeatedly, the most dangerous thing a president does is meddle in the intelligence community. When Bush meddled with Middle Eastern intelligence, we ended up in the Iraqi war and the Afghanistan situation. We're still in today. And this is just the internal version of that same kind of stuff. And I wrote a few notes on this story, Joe, and it's now longer than an op-ed. So I'll just stop there and let Linda, because I know she had stuff she wanted to say.
No, I want to hear what you said. I want to hear your notes, Jim.
Well, I mean, there's a few different things I'd say. But, you know, one of the things that comes out in the story that's mentioned that I also think is really important is the two top officials at the DHS are referred to as both appointees of President Trump who have not yet been confirmed by the Senate for their positions. That's something he has done throughout the government. He has his people running it and found a way to circumvent the Constitution. And then the other thing I find incredible is the president's Homeland Security advisor, Mr. O'Brien, is saying he never heard of Mr. Murphy, right? Mr. Murphy is the head of the Homeland Security Department's intelligence branch, which is briefing that group. So either, you know, the administration is lying, surprise, surprise, or, you know, if you believe them, it's even worse that they weren't even listening to their own briefings. So it's just crazy, and it gets worse and worse.
Linda?
I really have nothing. I mean, Jim knows a lot about this. That's why I wanted to hear what he had to say. I mean, it is clear in asking that they de-emphasize certain things and emphasize others, you know, and that they de-emphasize internal domestic white terrorism. That to me is horrifying. Once again, that is basically saying, well, that's okay. That's okay. You know, white violence. I need to say something on the subject of white violence that I don't think I've said on this show, but I think I'm going to keep saying it every time I'm on it because I am so tired of hearing about the arguments against black violence and looting and destruction of property and violence. I'm an old lady. Let me just point out that during the 50s and early 60s, there was never a single white protest against integration that was not violent. So these people, this administration, wants to say that that's okay. It's not okay. It is not okay. And it's not new.
But I wanted to go back, if I could, to Jim, because here's the interesting question. And that is, our whole international perspective is determined by what the President of the United States and his people are saying. Mm-hmm. And basically they're saying, we find it very convenient, if I can interpret, we're finding it very convenient to have two main enemies that we think the American people can get to, the Chinese and the Iranians. And please leave our friends the Russians out of it. Do never talk about the Russians. That's pretty scary, isn't it, Jim?
Yep. And also the internal. You know, so one of the things to note is that these DHS bulletins that are being meddled with here, these are not typically public. These are things that are released internally to the states, to the FBI, to, you know, I mean, these are the things that DHS was created to help protect us, the American people. And I just find it so stunning that when that's being meddled with to the point of, you know, electoral politics makes it so we're not going to try to worry about who's meddling in the vote. Electoral politics lets us tell you that, you know, let's blame the blacks and not the whites for all the violence. It's just, you know, makes it so impossible for the states and for the particularly counties and lower levels to know what's going on. This is why we created DHS, and they're being subverted. And it just gets me angry. I'm sorry.
Well, and assuming that the answer to this is the answer to so many things that we discuss on this program of late, which is, you know, what can we do about it? And probably nothing, right? I mean, somebody blows the whistle, and then what? Dot, dot, dot.
Vote, vote, vote. You know, the IG, right, yes. if they pursue it, right now DHS actually has a pretty good IG. There's a review of their IG. Their office has requested a review by the National Academy of Public Administration, which reviews government agencies to make sure their IG is looking at the right things, more in process. But, you know, if the IG starts to go in this direction, we already know they'll get fired. Trump's already done
exactly.
That. You know, that. Again, he's just found ways to manipulate the government that are legal. Quote, legal, unquote, simply because no one ever thought anyone would do it and made them illegal. And, you know, I certainly hope that someday when Trump isn't the president anymore, the Congress will figure out that they have to pass some of these things into laws. You know, after Nixon, some things were changed. I hope that will happen again here.
You make a brilliant point, and especially if the Senate turns Democratic. And Biden is elected, then you may well get that. But, you know, it's funny. All too often the people who are in charge suggest to themselves, you know, we may want to do some of the same stuff ourselves, and not an awful lot gets changed for exactly that reason. Now we're in charge, and we want to make sure, even though Trump was terrible, we want to make sure, if we want to, quote, adjust the system, we can do it.
I remember you giving a brilliant example of that one time, Alan, of saying that, of using the Merrick Garland example of if it were the Democrats who had the opportunity to hold a Supreme Court nomination next time, you know, would they do it? Probably yes, right?
You know, it's too bad because we see, for example, in the state legislature, the Congress, when it comes to reforming the system, everybody's for it when you're on the other side, and when you're in control, hey, maybe not such a good idea because we may want to do it too.
The filibuster.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to, I think we have 4 minutes left, so let's go to, while we're talking about Supreme Court, Donald Trump, while all of this was going on with the Bob Woodward book, the president didn't quite know what to do, so he apparently, according to publicized or published reports, convened a very quick press conference and decided to name 20 people that he would consider as potential Supreme Court justices, and then challenge Joe Biden to release his own list of nominees, saying that it was very important, saying that he must release a list of justices for people to properly make a decision as to how they will vote. On the list, Ted Cruz is on the list. I know you're excited. Let's see. And then there's a lot of people that we don't know, in the sense of 8 judges from the Federal Appeals Court, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, McConnell protege who spoke at the Republican National Convention, also made the list, Josh Hawley of Missouri, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, GOP senators, as well as Ted Cruz. Alan, this is a relatively new phenomenon, is it not, of the asking of a candidate to release
SCOTUS and of nominees? Course and of course, Joe, the proper response is, I will when you release your tax returns. And it shouldn't be so hard, but it is a way, once again, of throwing red meat to the base and saying, be sure you get out there, because when I tell you I'm going to make Ted Cruz, who's called, by the way, Trump, terrible names earlier, when I tell you I'm going to make him a Supreme Court judge, you better run out and get to the polls. That's what this was all designed to do. And you're right, it was just a stall.
My quick Googling of these people is those who do, where I could find something on the records talking about Roe versus Wade, were consistently people who wanted to overturn it. And of course, he mentioned Tom Cotton, who immediately tweeted, it's time for Roe versus Wade to go.
Yeah,
I mean, unbelievable. You know, so much for potential Supreme Court justices claiming to
going with the law. Yeah. Right.
Linda?
Final words. I just wait for the moment to hear the words come out of his mouth. I would like to nominate for the Supreme Court my nominee, Lying Ted.
Ivanka.
Yeah, Ivanka.
No, I mean, there is no bottom to the hypocrisy here. And this is being done because Trump has nothing to lose with this gimmick, but because Republicans, we cover a lot of different views in the Democratic Party, it will not do Joe well to be naming Supreme Court possible nominees right now at all, and there's no reason for it. Alan's right. Show us your taxes first.
We are out of time.
Then we'll talk about Lion Ted.
My thanks to everybody this morning for being with us. Alan, thank you very much. Jim, Sienna, Linda, thank you. It's always wonderful to have you aboard. Thank you. Coming up next, we will have more program right after this.